Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Great. So I think we're going to get started. So ladies and gentlemen, welcome to LSE for today's online event, which forms part of the LSE Festival, Power and Politics, that has been taking place throughout this week and will end complete tomorrow, Saturday the 15th, where we are exploring how power and politics shape our world. Today's free lunchtime LSE Skills Online session is hosted by LSE Online. Each day throughout the festival, we have invited LSE experts to deliver bite-sized professional skill sessions on topics covering inclusion, people management, decision-making, sustainability, and data regulation. My name is Lisa Hovdal, and I'm the head of marketing at LSE Online. It's a program making LSE's world-leading education accessible to a global audience. We provide a comprehensive portfolio of online programs to equip you and your organization with the knowledge and skills to advance in an ever-changing world. I'm now very, very pleased to welcome Professor Giles Atkinson and Dr. Matthew Agarwala. Giles Atkinson is Professor of Environmental Policy at the LSE Department of Geography and Environment. He has published a large number of highly cited books and articles on sustainability economics and measuring sustainability, as well as teaching on these topics, including on LSE's online certificate course in sustainability. Giles has also been a member of various advisory bodies, including the UK Natural Capital Committee and expert committees for the World Bank and UK Office for National Statistics. Matthew Agarwala leads the Bennett Institute's research on sustainability, green productivity, and well-being at the University of Cambridge, where he has been based since completing his PhD at LSE. He is a member of the Productivity Institute, Senior Policy Fellow at Yale University's Tobin Center for Economic Policy, and Honorary Professor at Scotland's Rural College. Matthew regularly contributes to international television, radio, and print media. Today, they will be exploring how we can measure economic progress and sustainability with practical illustrations. What does it actually mean to move beyond gross domestic product as the primary way that nations use to measure economic and social development? How is thinking about nature as capital a key step in this journey, and why? More generally, focusing on national and planetary wealth is a better guide to economic and social development prospects. Before we start off, for those of you who are using social media in the audience, please do use the hashtag for today's events, which is LSE Festival. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties our end. As usual, there will be a chance for you to put your questions, so please do use the Q&A function here. And I would urge you to start submitting questions throughout the session as they come up, as Giles and Matthew talk you through it. But please also do include your name and affiliation. So we'll get to the Q&A towards the end. So do submit queries. On that note, I'm going to hand over to you, Giles.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Well, thank you very much, Lisa, for that that introduction. Let me just share the slides that I have put onto the. Oops, there we are. Okay, thank you. Well, thanks very much for that introduction, Lisa. I'm really delighted to be here at this lunchtime for this session. Equally delighted to be joined by my colleague, Dr. Matthew Agarwala. So thank you, Matthew, for being here as well. Lisa's mentioned about the objectives for the session, but let me just say a little bit about that. And also in relation to the theme for LSE, the LSE Festival this year. So the festival is about power and politics. So our session is going to be about indicators and statistics. But I think, you know, it's a really important thing to remember is that these are metrics which are used to support political decisions. And we can also use these indicators to see if political rhetoric, you know, for example, commitments to sustainability that our political leaders are often fond of making, whether those are matched by reality. I mean, that's essentially what we want from these indicators which go beyond GDP. But our overarching question today essentially is whether the key metrics that typically our decision makers, our politicians use for their decisions, whether they're really up to the task. And a lot of that debate does focus on GDP. We're going to use that abbreviation a lot during this session, or gross domestic product. Particularly, we're going to look at, well, what's it mean to actually go beyond GDP? So what this really reflects is a concern that you're going to get poor political answers to many new questions we have if you rely on conventional indicators such as GDP. So what we need is essentially more broader, more novel ways of thinking about the measurement challenges that we have today to respond to new questions that we have, such as, you know, is the economy sustainable going forward? Now, I think it's important to mention that we may have lots of different ideas about what that actually means in terms of a plan for action. So we might all coalesce under this umbrella of we need to go beyond GDP, but what that means for you, what that means for Matthew, what that means to me, is going to be a very broad range of activities indeed. So some of what Matthew and I are going to say in this session reflects our own perspectives in this particular debate, but we'll try and broaden that out as well, and hopefully in the questions we can sort of deal with some of the broader aspects of this debate too. So firstly, we'll say a little bit about what GDP is and what some of the issues are. We'll talk about, as Lisa mentioned, the way that looking at wealth might be a better guide. We're going to tell you a little bit about what's going on around the world. It will be a mad dash through some of the initiatives that are happening. And lastly, we'll just give some illustrations for the United Kingdom on this question, you know, are national economies sustainable? Okay, we did wrestle with this, whether we would have to say, you know, what GDP is. So we felt it was unavoidable. So let's just start out, get it out of the way. What is GDP? Well, I guess the simplest way of saying this is it's a measure of current economic activity. And essentially, it's the economic activity that occurs within a nation over some period, usually a year, although GDP, gross domestic products, is measured on a quarterly and a monthly basis too. There's a lot of uncertainty associated with those numbers, but you'll see them in the news, in the press, etc., reported in that way as well. So without getting into too much of the technical detail, there's essentially three ways that national accountants have for measuring GDP. But what this boils down to is, in essence, just measuring all of the transactions that happen in an economy. And the image on this slide kind of illustrates one of these approaches to estimating GDP, and it's called the expenditure approach. So essentially, this is just counting up all the things that we spend our money on in a given period, a given year, for example. So it's all the spending made by households, all the spending made by governments on public services. So that's the consumption that we carry out in a particular year. But it also measures investment expenditures as well. So when we invest in things like buildings and roads, the expenditure, the transactions associated with that. And lastly, it also measures net trade as well. So this is what other countries spend on our exports compared to what we spend on imports, for example, in the United Kingdom. Now, as I say, there's other approaches to measuring this. You look at the incomes that people earn. You can look at the value of things that businesses sell, for example. All three of those approaches should give the same answer. There's some statistical discrepancy, quite typically. And I did mention that Measuring GDP is the job of the National Statistical Office, and it's a huge statistical exercise. So, Matthew, I'm going to bring you in here to say a little bit about what that statistical exercise involves, if I may.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. I'm absolutely delighted to be back here at LSE. This is where I did my PhD. And in fact, for those of you who don't know, Giles was actually my PhD supervisor. So for me to be invited back to participate here is an absolute treat and a pleasure. I think one of the interesting things about this, as Giles mentioned, it is the role of the National Statistical Office to compile the GDP accounts. But one of the core strengths of this economic measure, gross domestic product, is that we can compare it across different countries. And we can compare it within a country, but over time. And that comparison helps us understand how is the UK performing compared to France and Germany, or the EU average, or the global average. And the only way that we can have those comparisons is if there is a common guidebook, a rule book for how you define and compile this data. Now, it's a massive data collection effort. The Office for National Statistics in the United Kingdom has around 5,000 employees. Now, not all of them are dedicated exclusively to the GDP component of data collection, but it's a sizable chunk. And they don't measure every credit card transaction. They don't measure every cash purchase that we make. That's not how this works. Essentially, what they do is they rely on surveys, and they send surveys out to different businesses, to different government departments, to try to get information about purchases and expenditures and consumption, et cetera. There are some interesting stories about how this plays out in practice. We've just seen in the pandemic how important daily economic and health data can be, and how powerful it can be in terms of political decision making. But the credibility of the data is really important as well. And sometimes, you know, when these surveys are handed out to various different companies, nobody really knows who's the right person to answer. And it often gets filled in by the summer intern, which, you know, that's not necessarily what we would want. We would want somebody with the right sort of oversight of the company. That said, it's the standard measure that we've got, warts and all. And it's how we assess the size of economic activity within a year. I think what's really exciting in the research world at the moment is that we're starting to ask really new questions about what macroeconomic statistics can really deliver for us. The history of GDP is basically trying to answer whether or not the country can afford to go to war. And that's true from the very start of economic statistics, going back to the Domesday Book in the 11th century. It was an exercise to determine the taxable basis of the economy to determine whether the king could go to war. It happened again. Striking example was the birth of modern GDP accounts was in the United States when President Roosevelt needed to know whether he could afford to take the U.S. into World War II. And he brought in a brilliant economist by the name of Simon Kuznets in order to try and identify whether or not the economic activity of the United States could support the additional cost of a war. And interestingly, on this slide, actually, Kuznets, his original proposition was that government spending should be considered a negative entry into the accounts. So instead of adding it, we should subtract government spending from the size of the economy on the grounds that if the government's spending it, the people are not. Now, Roosevelt, knowing that the American people are going to have to support the war effort, said, actually, I'm not going to be able to do this if it looks like all of this extra expense for military personnel, equipment, supplies, all of the war effort is going to be shrinking the economy. So why don't we change that minus sign into a plus sign? And it was a political decision then that gave us the modern equation that you see here on the slide.
That's a great point, Matthew, because we tend to think of this all being codified in rules that have been with us for forever. And I mean, I suppose modern GDP has been around for, what is it, since the early 1950s, and codified in a book that United Nations Statistical Office publishes, 700 odd pages. If you ever want to soothe yourself to sleep at night, that would be my go-to book if you're ever in need. I really like the you say the warts and all, because we come here not to defend GDP necessarily, although it is important to recognise what it does. But I guess this is a debate about the amount of the warts and the size of the warts that now are becoming evident. So shall we say a little bit about that? Let me move on to this next slide. So I mean, you establish what GDP essentially has been trying to trying to do. Essentially, before it came, we didn't really know much about the size of economies. But in terms of the what's wrong with GDP, I suppose we could spend the rest of this session just going through a list of that, and there's been lots of books written on this topic. But what would you say would be the sort of the main issue that you'd mention? I've got one. What about yourself?
Well, there are a few things. One of my favorite books on this topic is by Professor Dame Diane Coyle, who is the director of the Bennett Institute, where I currently work, and a close colleague of Giles in the past as well. And her book is called GDP, A Brief but Affectionate History. And we can challenge GDP, but we should also recognize that it's been a really useful measure for us. It's great at measuring the amount of stuff that we produce in a year, the value of stuff we produce in a year. And for much of the 20th century, when GDP was kind of developed, that was the overarching challenge. People didn't have enough stuff. They didn't have enough food, shelter, clothing, transport, healthcare, etc. And GDP is a great measure of the economy's ability to produce those goods and services and alleviate that poverty. But now the challenges that we face as a country, as a global economy, are slightly different. It's not so much just that people don't have enough stuff, although there are many who are still far too poor. The big challenges that we face as a national or even global economy now relate to collective action problems, things like sustainability, climate change, biodiversity loss, but also the changing nature of the economy. We used to produce lots of trinkets and doodads. We would produce machines and cars and phones and these sorts of things. Now, the biggest share of value added in the economy for a place like the UK isn't trinkets and widgets and physical items. It's ideas. It's patents and software and business practices. And we're really in the knowledge economy. And GDP struggles to measure some of these issues. So the knowledge economy, patents, intangible capitals, things like best business practices, valuing skills. These are really difficult for GDP statistics to cover. Another challenge is the quality of goods. So we used to produce televisions in the 70s, and we still produce televisions today. They cost about the same amount in terms of the number of pounds you pay on a television, but the quality has changed radically. Adjusting for quality in these accounts is tricky. Now, the biggest issue that I have, though, is really with respect to the environment and sustainability, which I think is the defining economic challenge of the 21st century. And that's what I came to LSE to study under Giles. So what was your top pick, Giles?
Well, I would say this issue of sustainability, because I think for a lot of us, I can't speak for everybody, of course, but this is kind of where we came in. I suppose the sense that even if you accept all the advantages that GDP has, national accountants will, I think understandably kind of rehearse the strengths of GDP, and they would tell you that, okay, you want it as a measure of well-being. It was never intended for that. So, there are those challenges. But I think just the fact that it doesn't tell us about whether current economic activity is sustainable or not. So essentially, you know, if you think about sustainability as essentially at its heart, it means about lots of things, but at its heart, it's an issue about development, not just now, but also in the future as well. So will future generations be as well off as we are, or are we passing on large intolerable costs to those future people? So if you think about then what you need as a as an indicator, we can only measure obviously stuff now, but we need an indicator of that we can measure now that's going to tell us, at least give us some clues as to how the future might unfold. And for all its other strengths, GDP doesn't do that. It's not sufficiently forward-looking enough, I suppose, yeah, would be my number one concern. But otherwise, there's lots of other issues following that. So should we say a little bit about this? Because I suppose, you know, this is not just our perspective, but a lot of our colleagues that work on this issue. So this is what we mean by essentially this kind of wealth-based approach to thinking about going beyond GDP. So GDP, you know, it's a measure of income, it's a measure of outputs in the economy. So essentially, it's measuring a flow of things. It's telling you something about the future, because if you can remember back to a couple of slides ago, that expenditure approach counts investment, but in particular things, it's not a full picture of how wealth is changing in the economy, but it neither is it saying nothing at all about that. But I think the issue is essentially what we need to actually start measuring is the wealth on which the economy is based. So, you know, we've got an election coming up in the United Kingdom. There's a lot of talk from our political leaders about growing the economy. Now, how is that? Where's that growth going to come from? Well, you know, one answer to that, well, it's going to come from the wealth that we have in that economy. So some of the, you know, the aspects that Matthew mentioned with regards to digital economy as well, the productivity of the economy. And so I guess the essence of where we do a lot of our work is essentially trying to essentially improve the way that countries measure things in their balance sheets. And that's essentially wealth, kind of the assets and the liabilities that countries have. Matthew, I don't know if you want to add anything to
I mean,
that.
The metaphor that I like to use is simply imagine that you're running a bakery. The size of the pie that you can produce in the future depends on the stock of ingredients in your pantry. Run out of ingredients and tomorrow's pie will be smaller. Well, it turns out that the economy operates in exactly the same way, except that the core ingredients of economic prosperity are not flour and sugar and milk. They're these capital assets that you see on the right-hand side of the slide. Produced capital, the physical infrastructure, the buildings, the machines, the computers that we have. Natural capital, the health of the climate system, healthy ecosystems, this stability of the climate, the cleanliness of the air. These are all economic assets. Social capital, the amount that we trust in each other, in business, in government, the ability of communities to overcome collective action problems, that is absolutely an economic asset. If I can't trust in businesses and in business systems, then I can't use my credit card to make a purchase online because I wouldn't trust that that data is going to be kept private and secure. Trust really increases the scope for economic transactions, and a lack of trust constrains economic output. And of course, there's human capital, the health and skills of the population. That's basically our education and the ability to use that education to add value in the economy. Combined, these assets make up our wealth. You can grow the economy, you can increase the size of the pie in any given year, your GDP, simply by raiding the pantry. But if you do that, you have fewer ingredients to generate income in the future. So what we're trying to do, and the work that I've been doing with Giles for a little over 12 years now, is improving the measurement of what's going on in our economic pantry. How do you define and measure and value all of these assets? And there are two other key areas that I think are really exciting at the moment. One is relating to the digital economy and how we capture this in economic statistics. If you think back to 20 or 30 years ago, if you wanted to send a message or make a telephone call, you would have to buy a sheet of paper, write out your message, buy an envelope, buy a stamp, go to the post office and deliver it, right? All of those actions leaves a statistical fingerprint in the data. Sales of paper, sales of envelopes, sales of stamps. Now we send an email and there is no statistical fingerprint. Yet the service of communicating information is still being provided. We just don't capture it in our economic data. And so how do we capture those sorts of services? I'm not just talking about sending emails. I'm thinking about the value of free digital goods like YouTube and Facebook and Twitter, which we may argue, some may argue that's not such a positive impact on society, but it is a huge impact on the economy. And so measuring those is really exciting. And of course, the other component is the environment. If we have a big oil spill and it's very expensive to clean up, the cost of that cleanup increases GDP. And so you might see GDP growth because there's this great big oil spill. That's insane. We need economic statistics that can actually reflect the priorities and ambitions of economies today. And so we need to adjust the way that we measure these statistics. And that's what our work is trying to do.
Yeah, we need sanity in our statistics. Should we talk a little bit more about environment, actually, because it's an excuse for me to show a pretty picture. So I guess sort of my question is like here is what do we see in this picture? On the one hand, it's a landscape, it's a habitat, it's an ecosystem. It's near the coast in Norfolk. Matthew, I don't know, you might recognize this.
It looks familiar.
But I guess the point, Matthew was making a point about, well, how would this actually fantastic vista here, how would that be reflected in GDP? Well, kind of typically, not at all. I mean, if tourists go to this area, and actually a lot of tourists do use this particular area, that spending would be recorded in GDP. Although it wouldn't be attributed to this particular area. So we'd never know it's because of the importance of this particular natural area. And Matthew's mentioned about the oil spill. So this puzzle that, God forbid, if there was an oil spill in this region, the cleanup would be considered to be a positive thing in GDP, even though the underlying asset has been degraded by this. So essentially, on the one hand, we're looking at a picture of a landscape, habitat, ecosystem. But if you are a national accountant increasingly concerned about going beyond GDP, you see this as an asset as well and part of the wealth of the economy. So essentially, this is what is meant by this term natural capital. So there are broader definitions of what natural capital is, but essentially it's thinking about things like ecosystems as assets that provide services that benefit the economy. And there would be a big list of services that this particular ecosystem asset might provide. It provides habitat for wildlife, like a nursery for fish that then enter our food system. It provides flood protection measures, so stops homes being flooded that are just within the vicinity of this particular landscape. It also provides lots of recreational opportunities as well. So part of this going beyond GDP and a lot of what's called natural capital accounting specifically is really trying to think a lot more explicitly about what's the underlying asset which is providing these services, measuring what's happening in that underlying asset and attributing the benefits, the services that it provides to that asset itself. So counting all those recreational opportunities by being provided by that asset so we can make better decisions. So we know, well, this asset is productive because of these particular services. It warrants protection in that sense. It's doing something valuable for us.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to remember that we're not just talking about it being nice to have some water birds and some insects around and nice views. These things make real impacts on how we design cities, how we deliver public utilities and public services. There's a brilliant example from New York City, one of my favorite cities in the world. But you know, dense population, lots of water around, but also because of the population, a lot of sewage being produced, and a lot of demand for fresh, clean water. And actually, one of the challenges the city was facing was, how are we going to provide water and sewage services for such a large and growing urban population? Well, one option was that they build a massive new $5 billion treatment facility for the city. And the other option was that they buy land in the Catskills Mountains, just north of the city. And those forests in those mountains clean and purify the water that comes into the city. So they don't have to have this bricks and concrete treatment facility. They can let nature do it for them. These sorts of examples pop up all around the world. Here in the UK, we have water companies that are using man-made wetlands in order to treat wastewater, so that they don't have to invest in bricks and mortar treatment facilities, which then require lots of energy to run, lots of chemicals to clean and filter out the silt. What we can actually do is use reed beds and wetlands that boost biodiversity and decrease costs. So it's not just, you know, small stuff hugging trees. This affects major infrastructure decisions, which is a part of the current election campaign.
Great point, Matthew. And I think as well, you kind of illustrate, and also the points that were made on the previous slide, just what a vast work program this is going beyond GDP. Shall we say a little bit now about what's happening around the world? So this is going to be a bit of a whirlwind tour. We're not going to try and be exhaustive here, but we'll try and pick out a few themes in terms of what's going on in different organizations, and I suppose just the character of that work that happens in different organizations. So, I mean, we've talked about GDP, and we've said that that's the preserve of national statistical offices. So there is a lot of work going on with regards to beyond GDP, particularly trying to better account for natural capital. In not all, but many statistical offices around the world. So each nation will have its own statistical office, won't necessarily have all the thousands of staff that that Matthew mentioned for the UK context, but it will, there will be a tangible office there. Quite often they are doing work with regards to trying to better understand natural capital and its contribution to the economy. The work program in the United Kingdom, for example, has been going on for probably, well, more than 10 years now. The United States, Matthew, when was it? Then when they published some guidelines on their work, was that last year or the year?
Just 2 years ago, the United States federal agencies, under the direction of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy from the Biden and Harris administration, produced a roadmap for producing natural capital accounts for the entire United States economy. It's a major step forward. Now, it's going to take 15 years to deliver those complete accounts, because there's an awful lot of statistical work that needs to go on in the background, but they're hard at work at the moment. And it's a really exciting step forward, especially when you consider the weight of the United States economy in the global economic output.
Yeah, and I suppose it's worth mentioning, I mean, these statistical offices, they do talk to one another as well, because a big part of this is really capacity building too. So those countries which are more at the forefront of this sort of activity, essentially sharing their knowledge, their best practice with other offices. So, for example, there are formal communities of practice with regards to natural capital accounting across the world. So kind of networks of these organizations. Matthew, I suppose it's worth mentioning World Bank and United Nations Environment Programme, very active in this area. They publish really interesting cross-country estimates of better balance sheets accounting for human capital, the education that's embodied in people, the natural capital that that countries have. And they've been doing that for a number of years.
This may not stand out as such a highlight in your career, but it did in mine. My first academic paper, my first academic publication was actually co-authored with Giles, and it was in the 2012 Inclusive Wealth Report by the United Nations. It was their flagship report, the first piece that the United Nations had done on measuring sustainability, measuring that economic pantry. And that was my first paper. The World Bank has a similar program called the Changing Wealth of Nations, which again, Giles's work I don't know if I should betray how long you've been working on this, but certainly for several decades now, Giles's work has been shaping the way that the World Bank and the United Nations and national statistics offices are actually trying to compile this information about measuring our economic pantry.
Yeah. Let's say a little bit about private sector business, because there is a lot of activity, it's worth mentioning, in the private sector as well. So this is not just something being done in a technical statistical office within a nation. There's also private businesses doing that, but they're often doing it for particular reasons. So, you know, for example, landowners that might own land on which provide ecosystem services, such as I just mentioned on the previous slide. The farmers might be looking for payments for providing those services, so they need to kind of measure what's going on in their land. And Matthew, you have some examples of the way that firms might be about their supply chains and the way that depends on nature.
Yeah, there are lots of businesses that are increasingly concerned about not just their impacts on nature, but on nature's impacts on their own business models. And so we get this term now called double materiality, where businesses are trying to understand both impacts and dependencies on nature. And one of the early leaders in this was Puma, the sporting goods company. They produce tennis shoes and rackets and these sorts of things. Their CEO at the time, Jochen Zeitz, was particularly interested in answering the following question. How would our company's profits and losses look if we had to pay nature for all of the things that nature does for our business? Right? You have to pay all of the other suppliers. What if we had to pay nature for the supply of carbon sequestration, of water purification, of natural resources? And what they found actually was that their profits would become negative. That is, what nature was providing for free to Puma was greater than what Puma was generating in profits. Now, that's a difficult thing for any CEO to stomach. But actually, the process of learning which areas of their business were most dependent on nature helped them make some really interesting business decisions. They changed the way that they ship and package shoes. Instead of having a rectangular cardboard shoebox, they used a cloth bag. That meant you can get far more shoes per shipping container and use far less paper, water, cardboard, and CO2 in the process. And you can even save money on those reduced expenditures on those inputs. It helped them decide that they're going to develop shoes out of different materials, less leather, more recycled materials. And they're actually able to find a niche in the market for delivering more sustainable products. One of the things that I think is most exciting when businesses try and do this is they find out actually far more information about their supply chain than they ever would have known through traditional business monitoring and accounting. And it's because these statistics that we develop for natural capital, they're a new lens for observing the economy. It's just a different perspective. And once you take that on, you learn all sorts of new things about your business, about your relationships with nature, but also relationships with other suppliers. And so we see an awful lot of companies now around the world that are interested in this, partially because they want to learn about their own business. But mostly, we think that the real interest is because consumers and regulators are starting to demand information about, for instance, the carbon footprint or the water footprint, the general sustainability of the products that they're producing.
Thanks for that. That's great. We should start wrapping up soon, but we're going to move on to another section. But just before we go from this bit, I just mentioned local and grassroots organizations, because that takes us into sort of another area of activity, because there's sort of far more emphasis on the process whereby we choose particular indicators. So there's more deliberation, you know, perhaps local communities talking about, well, what sort of indicators do we need to kind of measure our well-being and its sustainability and so on. So I think that's interesting, because it's sort of another another sort of branch of activity away from the very kind of expert-led top-down approaches, say, of the National Statistical Office, but worth remembering that. We wanted just to finish by saying a little bit about, well, how do we know if national economies are sustainable? So we pose this question right in the title. I guess we should try and answer it to some extent in the final few minutes before we hopefully answer some of your questions. You know, essentially, this is about, well, what do we think sustainability actually means? So what does it mean for an economy to be sustainable? But essentially, if you're thinking about this wealth-based approach, then what wealth is telling you is, well, what is your well-being or your development going to be in the future? You know, as Matthew was talking about with his comparison with the pantry, the ingredients and the size of the pie, you know, is that pie shrinking over time, or is it growing? And essentially, you're really not only going to know an answer to that question by looking at what's happening to wealth in the economy. So this just gives some illustrations of what sort of activities that might entail. This is just an illustration of some work that the Office for National Statistics in the UK has been doing for some years now. It actually estimates the value of UK natural capital, and it does this for regions as well. It divides up that value of natural capital into to various categories. So provisioning here essentially means what natural capital does in terms of providing us with things like food and energy and so on. Regulating would be things like flood protection, sequestering carbon in ecosystems, trees, etc. And cultural is things like recreational activities that natural capital provides us. So in its most recent publication, where it estimated the value of UK natural capital for 2021, apparently, UK natural capital had a value of 1.5 trillion. Is this a big number? Well, for me, it's an enormous number, but that's probably not the relevant comparison. For context, in 2021, GDP in the UK was £2 trillion. The value of produced capital, if you look at something actually that is measured conventionally in the balance sheet, you know, things like buildings, that's over £5 trillion. So on the face of it, actually, this number maybe seems relatively small, although we could ask, okay, how large do we expect it to be? So I think, you know, just a kind of like a caveat to say, very exciting things happening in this sphere, but we also have to have a sort of a healthy skepticism about, is the work that's being done, does it yet do justice to the importance of natural capital to the economy? And that's important for political decisions as well, because decisions that we make quite often about natural capital, they're irreversible. So we need to be sure that we're making a decision that at least hopefully ex post will seem sensible as well. Matthew, I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
No, I think that the 1.5 trillion is almost certainly a gross underestimate of the value of the assets that nature provides. It's an excellent start. And I'm not knocking the Office for National Statistics. Yeah. The UK can be very proud about the fact that our natural capital accounts delivered by our ONS are amongst the most complete and most reputable anywhere in the world. But there's still a lot of work to be done. There's entire sections of nature that are not included. For instance, biodiversity is not directly valued and included in this. So we're telling you about natural capital, but we're not including biodiversity in a direct manner. So there's a lot more work to be done there. Yeah. I think, you know, in this section on are economies sustainable, I would be remiss if I didn't at least acknowledge and thank my Cambridge colleague, Professor Sarpartha Dasgupta, who was also at the LSE for a period of time, I believe, who has helped deliver the theory that underpins all of this work, and has spurred an entire global program of research. And the way that I think he would describe the sustainability rule is more or less that the pantry, right, that combined set of natural, human, and produced capital assets, the size of the pantry per person is not falling over time. Right? So we can use up these assets in order to generate income to produce pie, but as long as we are reinvesting enough in restocking the human, natural, social, and produced capital, then more or less the economy can be said to be sustainable. Unambiguously, if we're shrinking the pantry per person, then we know the economy is on an unsustainable.
And let's just whiz through a couple of other issues before going to just key takeaways. We talked about national wealth, but this is also about how we as a national economy use planetary wealth as well, and about how we might use the wealth of other nations. So a lot of consumption, for example, in the United Kingdom is going to have deforestation in other parts of the world embodied in it, because essentially that land was cleared to provide the goods and the services that we imported. This picture here is just telling us something, sort of a slightly different story about United Kingdom domestic emissions of carbon dioxide. But of course, there's also the emissions of carbon dioxide, which are embodied in the goods and services that we import from around the world as well. So in some sense, we're responsible for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. I think the takeaway from this slide, though, is that on both counts, both the emissions that we release within our borders and the emissions released somewhere else in the world to satisfy our consumption, there's been a major drop in the UK over the past few decades. In fact, the UK is one of the best performers in the world on this.
Yeah. And just lastly, I mean, there's other ways of thinking about this. So, you know, we've talked about balance sheets, we've talked about national accounts, but look, there's other ways of thinking about development and how to measure it. Yeah, a particularly interesting way, I think, is to actually make use of surveys which ask people who are experiencing development and sort of economic change, you know, how satisfied are they with their lives, and sort of picking out the determinants of why people answer in a particular way. This is information collected by in the United Kingdom by our statistical office, looking at the percentage of people rating their overall life satisfaction with their life as being low. And you can see it trending down in the early 2010s, but coming back up in the our current period. So you do get fresh insights from these other perspectives as well. So our message isn't that there's just one approach to looking at this. Let's go to just key takeaways, and hopefully we've got time for some questions. Beyond GDP, a broad debate about how we measure economic social progress within a nation. You know, we are focused in particular, I mentioned this message a few times, that one strand is really, useful to look at the wealth in the economy, not just national wealth, but also planetary wealth as well. Going beyond GDP, it can start within national accounts, which is why statistical offices are actively involved with this, but actually it can happen elsewhere as well. It could happen in businesses, it can happen in local communities. So this is a huge area of public and private sector activity. And there are really also a large range of different activities that are happening. And those really reflect the different strategic and policy priorities that these individual organizations and sectors and so on have. And I'll leave it there. But thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much, Professor Atkinson and Dr. Agarwala, for a very interesting session. We're now going to open up for some questions. And we've already had a bit through, so I'm just going to kick us off right away. We've got a question from Bianca Shinelli, who says, I wonder how pollution generated by economic activities is embedded in current GDP measures and how current model could be changed to take this into account.
It's a brilliant question. The fact is, under current GDP measurement, pollution is largely not included whatsoever. So we release carbon into the atmosphere. It mostly isn't included. Air pollution mostly is not included. But these things can be incorporated because we have these natural capital accounts. We are now able to incorporate these, and we can develop measures where we deduct the value of the emissions or the pollution from GDP statistics. One of the pieces of work that I've been doing recently is looking at how would productivity measurement differ if we deducted the value of the pollution from output. Typically in the UK, well, globally, we don't measure this. So if you had two factories, both producing the same number of cars and exactly the same inputs, but one factory released loads of pollution and the other factory released no pollution, mainstream productivity statistics cannot distinguish between those two. Right? But with productivity and net zero, both so high on the political agenda, we need economic statistics that can make that distinction. And so because we have the natural capital accounts in the UK, we can start doing that. And we're delivering that evidence now.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. We've also got a question. So hopefully we'll be able to get through because we've had a lot of questions now. So we'll try and get through, but I can't promise. We've got a question from Kirsten Morrison, who says, given the significant investment in skills needed to develop wealth accounts or even just natural capital accounts, how can its adoption be scaled up across all countries, including in low-income countries with very limited resources? How important is this given reliance on the natural capital of other countries in our global supply global supply chain?
Another really, really good question, because it's something that we didn't really touch on, although we could have. Matthew, at the beginning, you mentioned about how many thousands of people work in the Office for National Statistics in the UK. So just to use that as an example, how many of the people are working on natural capital accounts? It's a small subsection of that. And typically in these statistical offices, the different parts of it need to, fight's maybe the wrong word, but they need to argue for their budget. And they need to do that on a regular basis. So there's a danger about whether these activities themselves are sustainable. So just because a country is in the vanguard at the forefront of, say, natural capital accounting now, doesn't mean it will be in the future. And as the question indicated as well, not all countries have the capacity to undertake that sort of work. I suppose if we think about it more optimistically, I mean, there are organizations such as the World Bank, United Nations, who really are trying to help develop capacity within particular countries. So there are these networks that try to develop expertise, but you know, it doesn't exist in a context of constrained budgets for statistical activities and you know how to allocate them amongst different things. So it's very much a challenge.
Great. Thank you very much. So we also got a question from Leonie, who's a current MSc student. It says, really great talk. Thank you. Going back to the analogy of the pantry, given that the pantry is ultimately limited, even if investment can expand or revitalize its current state within those parameters, should economic growth even be a goal in the long term? Should it even be a means?
Great question. I get this question an awful lot. I both love and loathe it. I am unabashedly a pro-growth economist. But the first question is growth in what? Not just growth in GDP. I'm more agnostic about this. I'm really interested in growing the economic pantry. And I'm not convinced yet. And I would love it if one of our students came and convinced me. But I'm not yet convinced that the economic pantry is absolutely finite. And the reason for this is that I think that social capital, human capital, and knowledge capital are not necessarily constrained by natural resource materials. even if they are in the ultra, ultra long run, I am absolutely convinced there's a huge amount that we could do to improve the relative shift and the reliance on different assets towards a more knowledge-based economy. The best places to go and look for this, for further information on this, if you're on the degrowth side, you'd want to take a look at Tim Jackson and Peter Victor. And if you're on the pro-growth side, I think you'd want to take a look at Alessio Terzi, my colleague at the Bennett Institute in Cambridge.
Great, thank you. See, we'll try and squeeze in one, two more questions. We've got a question from Victoria Odinga from Kenya, and she's asking both of our speakers, what is the distinction between human capital and knowledge capital?
Ah, great question. This one's quick. Knowledge capital doesn't retire or die, but human capital does. So at some point, I will retire and no longer be using my skills to generate economic output. But the accumulated best practices, the knowledge, the best way of doing things, things like Henry Ford is long gone, but we still know all about the moving supply chain and interchangeable parts. Those knowledge assets are still with us.
How to bake your pie. Let's keep the pantry analogy going.
Great, thank you. So we're going to squeeze in one last question. So this is from Parth Bhatia, who's an LSE student. A major utility of GDP accounts is in guiding financial capital allocation. How would alternate measures of domestic value creation influence decisions in global financial markets? And what would alternate measures of wealth value mean for developing countries that are desperate to attract financial capital for the green transition?
Giles, do you want to take it?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose at a high level, there is this issue where we talk about the value of natural capital, that it provides all these valuable services, protecting habitats, protecting the climate. There is a sort of a hard-nosed thing about that. Well, can I actually capture that value? If you're a finance minister, that's going to be on your mind, I suppose. So, we just show it, these accounts quite often are just showing potentially what something is worth, trying to indicate its importance. The interesting thing is then how you translate that to something, maybe, if you are interested in kind of leveraging that value in some way. I need to demonstrate that value in order to justify protecting it. There's another set of questions. Matthew, I'm sure you have some other.
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right to identify the fact that where the finance lives in the world, New York, London, Paris, right? And where the biodiversity and ecosystem assets live in the world, Rwanda, Congo, Brazil, they don't line up very well, right? And so there is a huge challenge to drive financial flows to the protection and conservation of these assets. But the fact is that investment and conservation are almost synonymous. They both entail giving up a little bit of something today in order to have a better return in the future. And so the policy challenge, the challenge for us as academic economists and for you as a student here, is going to be, how do you design the incentive mechanisms in order to drive financial flows towards the conservation of these particular kinds of environmental assets? And the way that we've got so far, offsets, biodiversity credits, debt for nature swaps, green bonds, these are the things we're working on at the moment. I think there's a lot more opportunity here. I think we haven't quite fully delivered on the promise of green finance, but I'd look forward to working with you on it in the future.
Brings us nicely back to our theme, though, because this is about how these information systems can be tied back to actually making political, economic decisions. And that's clearly a huge sort of area to think about.
Great. Well, on that note, thank you so much, Matthew and Giles, for a very fascinating discussion, which I hope all of the listeners really enjoyed. There are lots more exciting events coming up tomorrow on the final day of the LSE Festival. So do check out the program on lse.ac.uk/festival. And you can also catch up on the various festival skills session either on LinkedIn or by visiting the LSE player. If you do want to learn more about the sustainability online certificate course that we do provide, please do visit onlinecourses.lse.ac.uk. And on that note, I'm going to say thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.